HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 299, recorded live Wednesday, December 21st, 2011. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. In this episode of Hansel Minutia, Scott talks with Richard Campbell.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes. This episode, we end the year with a whimper or a bang. I'm not sure which. It's going to be a Hansel Minutia, which is great for the people who love them, who say that there's been a year that's gone by since the last Hansel Minutia with Richard Campbell. And then for the people who hate Hansel Minutia, what a great way to end the year.
Nice.
How's it going, Richard?
I'm good, sir. How are you?
Always a treat. Always a treat. We're well. We're well. Christmas is lovely, lovely, lovely.
Well, and you're at the time in your life with little kids that Christmas is just a huge deal. It's the thing.
It is the biggest thing ever. There is no larger event in the world than Christmas.
Yeah, and I have teenage daughters, so it's a little mellower. Although they make all the cookies and they do all the gift wrapping for me.
That's pretty good. Nice. Actually, gift wrapping is the one thing I enjoy.
Really? Yeah. And it's a thing, you know, it sort of enjoy it. It's also happens to be we're recording this on the winter solstice. So happy solstice.
Oh, that's good too, I guess.
Yeah. Longest night of the year. It, you know, for us optimists, the days only get longer for here.
That's a good way to look at it.
It's also Saturnalia. Don't forget Saturnalia.
Okay. What is Saturnalia?
Saturnalia was the ancient Roman week of festivals for the sort of end of the year. The solstice factored very importantly into it. They also did gift giving towards the end of that week. Everybody got gifts. They lit candles on the solstice because it was the longest night of the year. And they made up these, everybody got this little clay discs with faces on them, a little circle on it with a sash tied to it. And after a certain ritual, they went outside and they hung them on pine trees.
I did not know that.
Just all these weird little, you ever wonder, the Western version of Christianity has all of these influences from all of these other faiths and mythologies and sort of ceremonies that we sort of picked and choose, I think, to assemble our own ritual.
My ritual is typically giving the people I love tablets for Christmas.
Nice. Kindle fires? Is that the one?
Indeed. Yeah, well, actually, Kindle fire, in fact, is what my mom just got.
Oh.
And honestly, I just don't see it going well. I just don't see how the Kindle fire is a good idea. And I wanted to know what you thought about it.
Well, we all love our Kindles, right?
Well, I mean, I've got a Kindle, and I think my Kindle's fantastic.
Yeah.
I've got absolutely no complaints. The Kindle is a brilliant device.
Right.
It's the right size.
I have not read a paper book, I swear, since, pretty much. I read constantly. I'm 50 to 70 books a year. Everything's through the Kindle. If I can't get it on Kindle, I can't read it.
Well, and I've read more since I got the Kindle than I think I've ever read.
Totally agree.
Before.
Yeah. It's a huge thing. But the Fire for me is an interesting device. Never ever ignore Amazon. Jeff Bezos is a genius. He's relentless. He is consistent. The original Kindle, if you recall, was under Power 2. It wasn't much of a device, but they'll keep replacing them. But he set an interesting price point at $200, sort of that floor price. This is the cheapest tablet device you can sort of make, I think. But it also is, and a few folks have said, underpowered, like just not muscular enough for what people really want to do. It is not an iPad.
Well, and that's the thing. People keep saying that I'm expecting too much in that I want a $199 iPad.
Right.
Because, I mean, say what you will about the iOS lock-in and the App Store and, you know, Apple in general and the way they're taking over the world, but it is buttery smooth.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if there's one word you can use, it is buttery smooth to describe the way working iPad. It never skips. It never, you know, nothing ever goes wrong from a frame rate perspective. But when you touch it, it works. And that's the difference. That capacitive screen is just fantastic.
Yeah. And priced accordingly, it costs a little more to make it that way. I'd say the other thing for me that's a big deal about the Fire is that it really speaks to the destruction of Android in my mind. You know, Google's making no money on Android, which really, in that respect, Android is sort of a spoiler of markets rather than a competitor in the markets. They open source the whole thing. You know, they play a bit of game with their own device and so forth. And there's a sort of certification process. So then it's just dribs and drabs of money. I mean, if you were to talk about the, you know, things about 2011, this is sort of where Google peaked. And now they clearly are unable to make money in other places. And it's getting serious now. But the big thing with the Kindle Fire is that, you know, Bezos has made no bones about, we took Android, we've customized it, it's a fork in the code, we're never coming back. See ya. And that, I'm now thinking the carriers have got to look at that and look at what, and I do expect Fire to be successful eventually. You know, Moore's Law will fix the Fire, right? So, give it another cycle of hardware and it'll, you know, things will be better. But I think that we're going to start seeing, I mean, Android's already got problems with fracturing, but you ain't seen nothing yet. Because, you know, Microsoft had problems with fracturing with WinCE just because they allowed it to run on all kinds of devices. They did this crazy technique for manufacturing a version of the OS based on the specs of a given device. And it just meant that it was impossible to program for. And Android's gone even further. They just handed out the source code and said, hey, go nuts. Go crazy. Have a good time. We'll keep updating it. And then they found out nobody will update. The carriers will not update devices. It's not in their genes, and it's actually against their business model. They'd much rather sell you a new device. Their whole business is built on giving you a new device every year, or every other year, depending on how much you want to spend. So they've got no incentive to ever upgrade anything. And now we're going to see it go even further, where it's just like, in fact, we're not only not going to upgrade, we're just going to go our own path down this OS and do what we want with it.
But does that leave an opening for someone to do the opposite? I mean, sometimes in business when something sucks and people say that the business is set up such that it is going to suck, like there's no way other than sucking that is allowed within the business model.
Right.
Someone comes along like JetBlue or someone and says, what? You know, being in an airplane has to suck. Food has to suck. Let's turn that on its ear.
Yeah. Let's make it a feature.
And then Virgin America does, you know, takes that and says, well, it has to be cheap and suck. You know, well, it can be awesome and fun and be like a nightclub in the sky, and then they change it. So couldn't someone come along and say, we're going to take old hardware and give it new life, and that's part of our business model?
Well, and you know, the interesting thing about Android is you have the cult of geek that can strip and root these phones and make them into quite cool phones, to take those old phones and sort of recycle them. So I don't know that anyone's really latched onto that yet, but the guys I know, they remind me of Linux people. People that were excited to build their own version of an OS onto their machine. There's a group of people that are like that with Android phones, that they get all the carrier crap off their phone. They get the latest build, you know, off of the main release line. They pick and choose the bits they want to put in, and they build out this phone, and their phones come back to life. You know, like they're much nicer. It's like a fresh install onto a machine, same sort of effect. So there is that element of it, but that is not how Android's being sold. Android's being sold by the carriers, and they want their devices to be unique, so every one of them is customized in some respect, and they are replaced, not upgraded. So that, you know, I see Android's huge uptake as the response to the carriers to the iPhone AT&T deal, where they needed a smartphone and they got one they could control. And then the plethora of hardware, you know, the hardware vendors are happy because they learned how to do small batch runs that are profitable. They make 20, 30, 50,000 of a given phone for a given carrier, properly logoed, and then they never make it again because they don't need to. Now they go into the next ref and the next ref and the next ref.
It's so wasteful.
It is. And it's also, you know, Apple goes the other way, because Apple picks a particular hardware rev and they keep it very tight, and they change a lot slower. So they're somewhat behind the curve, but their manufacturing processes are different because they're not designed to change quickly. You know, the side effect of when you're constantly making a new phone every quarter is that you don't densify too much because you don't have time, and it's not going to stay. And you keep things modular. Your chipsets stay with little connector plugs, and your antennas are modular. Like all of those things stay modular because they need to be. Because you end up buying a year's supply worth of antennas. They need to fit in several different cases, so they're not perfectly fitted to the case. So, you know, generally speaking, Android devices, the way they're made, is designed to be replaced you know, frequently and often, where the Apple devices are designed to be held onto. And again, never upgraded, never modified in any way, just replaced with new ones, just at a lower cadence.
Yeah, definitely. And I've been impressed, actually, how Apple has allowed people to upgrade to the latest version of the OS for even, at this point, I think even the 3G can have iOS 5.
Yeah.
They just basically turn off different features.
Right. And the reality, of course, is that actually helps sell newer phones. You know, my girls love their 3GSs with iOS 3 on it. But once iOS 4 went on it, and everything went slower, the pressure went up on me to replace their phones.
What happens when everyone has a phone? We just start piling them and then, you know, building houses on top of foundations that are based on trashed phones?
Well, yeah, the other side of that is the chemistry. Recycling phones is incredibly hard, especially these custom manufactured ones, iPhones. Like, they don't disassemble particularly well. Mm-hmm. And there really hasn't been a lot of discussion about things like the rare earth minerals that are involved in building electronics that are getting harder and harder to get a hold of.
Right.
And we're gonna hit a point where, you know, the value in beryllium is so high that it's worth recycling phones just to get those rare minerals out of it. Because those, right now, you know, the joke about rare earth minerals,
yeah,
they're cheap. Then they're really not all that rare. But they're expensive to refine. And so it's actually a challenge to keep the flow up. And we consume all of these very, like, you have no idea the nutty elements that are in these phones, and we've got to deal with them all. So yeah, as the smartphones start to push out to the massive billions, because they're not there yet, we're going to have an interesting problem in dealing with them. But they can be recycled downward. Honestly, I think Android's in a better position to recycle downward than anybody else, just because their ability to be modular and to clear off the software and to rebuild.
It's a shame that they don't embrace that, because there's such potential.
It's not Google's focus at all, right? I'm not sure that Google knows what Google's focus is in dealing with Android.
That's true. I mean, honestly, I think one could pick any of the various focuses that a company could have and argue that that is Google's focus. Like, I would have said advertising.
Yeah. Well, advertising is their cash cow, right? Which is really, you know, oriented on search. And it's the only thing that's ever made them any real money. And they've been trying very hard to start generating revenue in other places, and really not doing all that well at it. Like, it's becoming very serious from a business perspective. It's like, if you can't diversify your income, you know, I noticed the other thing that's happened is Microsoft, after years of being very worried about search, you know, set a goal of, we want to have 30% of the search market. They made it this year with the Yahoo Bing deal is now 30% of the search market, and they've started cutting back on their spending on search. Their losses, they've never made money on search, but their losses have gone down. And I also noticed that, you know, the senior important people that were totally focused on Bing have now moving into other teams. So it's like, it almost seems like Microsoft has achieved the goal they set out to achieve, that sort of 30% market penetration. But I'm used to Microsoft. You remember Brian Valentine's quote about Office?
What was that?
We feel that Office should have its fair share of the marketplace, and its fair share is 100%. Well, and you know, that I think is the insider's view of Microsoft. They are a relentless beast that wants to completely dominate things, but it doesn't seem that way in search. Now, it doesn't mean that they're just failing, because they've struggled for a long time, but they've genuinely gained market share. But you're seeing them start to cut back on their search spending, you know, that near $1 billion losses. At a 30% marketplace, are they happy there? That's good enough. That makes the difference. Or are they also perceiving that search is becoming less relevant? Don't spend billions trying to win a market that ultimately doesn't matter.
That's interesting. You know, and I also wonder how they will continue, how companies in general, but Google specifically, will continue to send free stuff out there into the world, and we all count on it. And the longer we count on it, the harder it's going to be for them to get rid of it. For example, they're sending Google Maps tiles around to everyone for free.
Yep.
And we just continue to suck it up. One day that's not going to be free. And already they're starting to charge for services, starting to shut services down.
Yeah. Well, and look at how much money Google has spent on. I mean, think about the Google cars running around with the cameras on them. All that data they've gathered. Like, they spend tremendous amounts of money on these free services. They have to, and as this tightening comes in, you know, the Google Gears, all these technologies, they're starting to shut down because they're just costing them money and not succeeding. They're going to start, the pressure to start generating other revenue means it's going to force them to take things that are actually popular and successful and make them cost.
Well, definitely. If you're going to build a startup and if someone's investing in it and they're going to look at your fundamentals and they realize that the entire system is based on you using some free service from anyone, from Google, from Microsoft, from whoever, that's going to be a problem.
Well, I think there's a fundamental conflict of interest there. The moment you're generating revenue off the back of somebody else's free service, we need to have a conversation.
Well, so that is actually an interesting point and brings me to the whole Zynga thing, the Facebook gaming people.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone thought that was going to be like the amazing hot IPO of the year. And then it, you know, it went up and up. And then it's like, wait a second. Every cent of their revenue is based entirely on Facebook.
Yep.
Which is a free thing that makes money off of advertising.
Yeah.
I mean, they're literally like a barnacle on like Facebook's butt. And people thought that that was a valid business.
Well, and I would argue this, you know, one of the things that Facebook trades on heavily is their mind space occupation, right? I just saw a graph come out where they showed that when it comes to spending time on social media, Facebook is 10 times the size of everybody else combined compared to LinkedIn or Tumblr or any of these other things. It's all Facebook time. And my automatic thought was that's game playing, right? That is not quote unquote social media. The huge time sink in Facebook is Zynga, are the game players. But those are not good advertising candidates either. People who are farming stuff in Farmville aren't looking at your ads. They've learned to block them out. I mean, I think in general, computer advertising isn't working because people's brains are programmed to not see them.
Right.
And to the point where if you actually put something important in a space that people normally think is an ad space, they will never find it.
From a UX perspective, you're saying like you design your system and you accidentally, it's like putting something crucial like the speedometer in a car right in the blind spot.
Yeah. If you put an incredibly important button of any kind down the right side of your web page, nobody will see it. Because it's where the ads go. And people have learned to simply block that out. The right-hand edge of my browser window is full of crap. It's never important, and I can't. And I've literally had to, you know, we've been experimenting with UX designs for different things, and we put something important there. Said, you know, go find this. Can't see it. Point to it. I thought that was an ad. Yes, you did. So did everybody else. Right? It's right, invisible.
Right. Well, it's advertising. But advertising itself as a strategy is all about consumption.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was thinking, the wife and I are keeping our Christmas we've kept our Christmas very low key. I mean, I think the boys are getting like 4 toys each and they're like action figures. You know, I mean, it's very low key. I think I'm getting 2 things and she's got 2 and the boys get 4 each. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, 2 Transformers and 2 action figures. So from a consumption perspective, I think our total outlay for Christmas was like $150 this year.
Well, and with young boys, they still rather play with the box anyway, right?
Well, there's that, but they also are kind of, they're wired to, you know, we go to Goodwill and we get toys are just something that you don't need to buy, right?
Yeah.
We'll build stuff out of wood or plastic or,
well, and they even enjoy that more, right? The process of creation is far more engaging than being handed something that has a particular play structure to it.
Right, right. But I guess my point is that consumption, we were sitting around a couple of days ago, we're like, you know, we don't need to go to the mall and get anything. You know, mm-hmm. We're very lucky. We've got a computer. We got a TV. We got lots of books. We got a bunch of toys and used toys and hand-me-down toys and we got wood that we can build toys with.
Yeah.
So we don't really need anything. So I'm not a very good consumer, I guess is the point that I'm making. And when advertising is all based on getting me to rush out to buy the new widget, then it makes me question advertising itself as a business model.
And I've wondered for years how much longer before Google ran through all of the people that were paying for AdWords and not getting back the sales that were necessary.
Exactly.
I mean, there's always the anecdotal cases of the folks that are really making it. And they've done a good job of basically overwhelming any other way to find sites.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the alternative to that is stuff like Etsy and eBay. And if you want to sell stuff online, there are mechanisms. And Google search sometimes works for that. But it's been gamed so heavily. It's been exploited so badly that it's becoming not the way to look for stuff. That's not how you try and find things anymore.
What do we sell when there's nothing else to sell?
We really don't need a lot, you know?
The first time I've ever seen you speechless.
Yeah, and think about what we sell. Mm-hmm. You know, it's amazing how valuable attention actually is.
You know, it is.
I realized my girls are literally at the edge of moving on, right? They're turning 20 and those sorts of things. And the thing that was most important, observing their behavior at Christmas, making cookies.
Mm-hmm.
The ritual of making these simple sugar cookies that they've made since they were little girls with mm-hmm. their mom and glazing them, and the sort of crafty art of making pretty snowflakes. I think the hip cookie for them this year was they made a whole bunch of Link Triforce cookies that they made their own templates for. And the younger daughter's into curling, so she made a whole bunch of curling rock cookies to give to her curling friends. But, you know, not the favorite ritual of Christmas is not an expensive ritual.
Yeah. And I think that's where my wife and I take our hints is we pay for experiences rather than stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah. You know, there's actually a lot of interesting blogs online about minimalism.
Yeah.
That are like, they literally are just blogs that show you how to live on as little stuff as possible. And then there's different people who have these challenges to like, you know, I own 100 things. Like, and he'll list out the 100 things that he owns.
Yeah.
Like total in his entire life. And another guy will come out, oh, I've got 75 things and here are the 75 things. And then they argue about like whether they count underwear as a collective or whether they actually count each individual underwear.
Is it a pair of socks one item or socks an item?
Exactly. but people go around and around about all this stuff that they need. So like when I was watching all the Black Friday sales, it's like, you know, I like my gadgets as not much as the next guy, but, once you have the basics, I don't see how the system's going to work. So taking this back up to the internet discussion, when eyeballs and consumption are on the business model, how sustainable is that?
Yeah. And I think it's because it speaks to an unsustainable model in the first place. And ultimately, I think it's losing traction bit by bit. You know, I think one of the interests in pushing Western culture into other parts of the world is that Westerners are getting tired of Western culture and it's not actually a good sales vehicle anymore. So let's go sell in India. There's lots of people and they think Western culture is kind of cool.
Yeah, which is interesting. So what does Western culture look like when Westerners are done with it and everyone else has adopted it?
And so exactly. And it all morphs like that. And looking again at my girls and the attitude and sort of viewpoint of their generation, these 20 somethings, you know, are a lot simpler and a lot less consumptive all around. I really enjoyed a book called The Third Industrial Revolution that spoke to this idea of more of a paradigm shift in the way we do things. And one of the axes on that was not only reduced consumption, but also getting away from the widely distributed model of power generation the centralized model of power generation into local power generation, mm-hmm. which the current grid, you know, over on .NET Rocks, we've been doing this series of shows called Geek Out Shows, and we're building up to a set of conversations around clean energy and smart grids and things like that. We just did a show specifically on electricity where I wanted to set some groundwork around of here's what I understand about the electrical grid and how the whole thing works.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the Industrial Revolution was this idea that we could start harnessing a power source for mechanical energy, and that changed things. It made cities really useful, that you needed a concentration of people in order to operate these factories, and you could produce a lot more stuff. And we've had a sort of second revolution in the technology space where, you know, now we had machines that were able to communicate faster and so on. And this third industrial revolution talks more of getting away from the centralization of these resources. That, you know, power generation specifically is the big one. You go to where the oil is, where the coal is, where the natural gas is, where the uranium is, and that's a very valuable resource that you exploit and then bring out to power plants to generate power in these large power generation facilities, because they're expensive and complex, and then distribute power long range. And we know that when you distribute power long range, it's not particularly efficient. And you can generate power locally with far less impact because of the technological evolutions now. So much better solar cells. Like, they've just now got a lab solar cell that is exceeding 100% yield,
mm-hmm.
because they're actually able to take a given photon and have it trip a number of other electrons in the path. So, you know, instead of just getting one photon's worth of energy, you're getting several out of the given photons. Really interesting technologies. You know, suddenly solar cells are not this terribly inefficient thing. They generate an awful lot of power, and you can put them on every roof, and you can start consuming all that power locally. And you get into this smart grid model where I share my power with my neighbor, that we don't need the larger grid in order to feed power to everybody. There's a lightweight grid that covers some of that. And, you know, bit by bit, the cost of consumption goes down. I think the post-Western society starts to look like that. We live in these tighter collective neighborhoods that we like, that are largely self-sustaining, and we trade amongst each other in a very peer-to-peer mindset. And I feel like, as software people, we understand this better than just about anybody. Like, I'm talking to electrical people who are trying to get to building a smart grid, a peer-to-peer grid, and they're baffled by it, because they've just never thought peer-to-peer. That's a very weird way to think.
But that's where networks were supposed to go. There was the whole personal area network idea, yep. and people were supposed to, and I don't think that really ever happened. I mean, too much concern about security and Bluetooth. So no one ever figured out a way to have, you know, kind of self-joining secure networks where you could talk to someone's computer just by the fact that you were near them.
Yeah.
But with something like power, it's less important. They set it up ahead of time.
Well, and funny you mentioned Bluetooth too, because I think Bluetooth is one of those technologies that just never got over its own complexity. That I think the personal area network will have a resurgence, but I think it'll be more Wi-Fi like, because as Wi-Fi has evolved, its power consumption levels have gone down. It speaks IP, which we have a very known set of security models around, and we're maturing. You know, that I wouldn't surprise me at all if we see Bluetooth go away, and you see wireless done with IPv6, IPsec style network negotiation, and much simpler, cleaner patterns of security for that.
And this idea of this direction that the conversation has gone in the context of power, back to what I was saying about how a wife and I pay for experiences, I think that if you're trying to sell molecules, it's going to cost you, because it takes energy to push molecules around the earth. But if you sell electrons, you can make those a lot easier. It's always cheaper to sell electrons than it is molecules. And at the very, very beginning, you and I were talking about how we buy a lot of books on Kindle and we watch a lot of movies on iPads and things like that.
Yeah.
Seems like those are experiences powered by electrons that require minimal amounts of molecules to make. That seems like a reasonable business model.
And I just see Microsoft just made an announcement that 2012 will be their last CES. They're not coming to CES in 2013.
Mm-hmm.
And it's maybe a bit of an extrapolation for me, but you get back to stop moving molecules, just move electrons, because the ability to do remote presence is getting so good. You know, Google Plus now talking about you can do the 8-way video conference and stream it to everybody.
Right.
So now this idea of why exactly are we having to gather for these things? I mean, I think look at the code camp surge, that let us gather for the things that actually matter to gather for.
Right.
If we're just doing information exchange, we can do that online a lot more efficiently. And finally, the technology is getting to a point where it's close enough to presence that unless you specifically want the elements of presence, you can do it remotely.
Well, I was on a mailing list recently. I'm not sure if you're still on it as well, where someone said, I think it was a guy in New Zealand, who said that his company has gotten tired of the something like $80,000 to $100,000 a month that they're spending flying people all over the world from a faraway part of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, we're going to go and spend a tenth of that on really good cameras and high bandwidth and work on presence and try to make presence happen and see if we can cut our our travel budget in half or to nothing, even better. I mean, that's really interesting, the idea that someone would change their consulting business and see if they could come up with a way. Like, would a business tolerate a virtual consultant that they could push around?
Yeah, and I think generally businesses tolerate that which is successful, right? Like, if you can actually get the problem solved. I mean, my challenge as a guy who does an awful lot of consulting is I've come to recognize I spent a day in an all-day board, executive level meeting where the actual valuable part of the meeting were the smoke breaks. Right? Two or three of the most senior guys in that room all smoked. And every 2 or 3 hours, every couple of hours, they needed a smoke break. And I don't smoke, but I went down, stood upwind of them, and had the most valuable conversations of the whole. And I realize, I come back and I'm like, I build a whole day, and I do charge a ton because I don't really want to fly to Europe to do this. I realize my total primary value contribution became 5 10-minute conversations. That's where we actually move that company forward in making decision making.
But then the question is, can you virtually go to Europe to get your 5 10-minute conversations?
Right. Well, and the challenge there is the informal conversation, the conversation around the cigarette, when there's less noise, less formality, outside. That's the part that nothing is recorded on. That's the part that, that's not where the hardware is. It is completely what do I actually sell? Why was that effective? That's some those points of trust. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this sort of intimate moment of trust. Like you've heard me do the formal presentation. You're impressed. We swayed some folks there and so forth. But these are the things, that you're starting to trust me. Watch for these things.
Right.
Part of that whole dynamic was me predicting the next stage of the conversation. I suspect we're going to go here next. Watch for these things.
Right.
And you start helping shape their viewpoint and what they can see of where we're going in the debate. And they get more comfortable with, I understand more. I can move things forward more. And mm-hmm. we actually get some results. I don't know that you can capture that remotely. I think I've counted on the intimate moments of meals, of sort of side conversations, those sorts of things to get results for companies for a long time.
Right. I think, though, that I'm assuming this, but maybe 120 years ago, during the emergence of the telephone, people probably didn't use the telephone as a very intimate discussion place. There wasn't a place where you connected. But all of us who grew up in the 70s or so remember spending hours and hours and hours on the phone. Mm-hmm. And many people got deep into relationships where if you counted the number of hours spent in person versus the number of hours on the phone, they might realize that, wow, our whole relationship is based on talking on the phone more than it is being in person.
But that's not happening with my kids, and I sure won't happen with your kids.
But is it happening on text and on Skype?
They've found another vehicle, exactly.
Right.
And of course, I also am a big believer in the idea that children rise to your incompetence level as a parent, right?
Right,
I was prepared. I laid extra phone lines. I was ready for teenage girls on the phone all the time. Did not happen.
Right. But so then the question is, when you're dead, because you're so, so very old, and then the new breed of consultant comes out and do, 20, 30, 40 years from now, are they going to be able to have those kinds of intimate discussions and connections that we currently swear would only be possible
in person.
In person.
Yeah.
And they're going to do them on Skype, or they're going to do them on, in some other way. And the thing is that we really just don't know.
Yeah, we don't know, but it is logical progression.
Even though it feels completely counterintuitive, and I think both you and I, given our generations, would say, maybe for the young people, but I'm still going to have to fly to Europe 3 times a year.
Well, I talk about I do this talk when I'm talking to parents about their kids on the internet. It says, we are immigrants. They are natives, right? We remember a time before, and they don't. This is their normal form of communication. It's always been their normal form of communication. They know nothing else. We don't remember a time before the telephone. They don't remember a time before the internet. And so they're as natives, they simply treat it differently. And I bring that description up for parents just to say, the reason you see it differently is that you will always see it differently.
Exactly.
Right? You need to come at this as an immigrant. You cannot come at it as a native, and that's fine. And so I think we're hitting that same sort of limitation in our working style that as technologically advanced as we might be, we are still immigrants. And that later generation will be the natives, and they will be, it isn't me that's the problem. It's the guy I'm talking to.
That's interesting. That brings up an interesting question I think I might explore in a future show. I've talked about the idea that even though I've been a professional engineer for almost 20 years, I still kind of feel like an amateur.
Yeah.
And I feel like I don't really understand it. And while I've got that kind of classic get off my lawn attitude towards some of these young folks, the 20-year-olds and 22-year-olds that seem just unspeakably talented, and my get off my lawn, you young punk, wait, talk to me in 20 years when you've got experience.
Yeah.
Kind of attitude is really based on not just envy, but my rejection of the fact that they probably are just simply that much better because they were always here, right? I mean, I wasn't programming at 6. How could I possibly compete with someone who was?
Yeah, but they also are only 20-something, so they haven't been programming that long. You know, I wrote my first line of code at 10, and so, it's been a long time, too. Yeah, also, there's an advantage to that depth of viewpoint, but there's also a distraction to it. I am stuck in some old-fashioned ways. I am prone to writing stored procedures. You know, like, those are skills that I have a hard time shaking off because I counted on for so long. They so deeply related to my success, mm-hmm. and now, in later life, these guys aren't hampered by that baggage. In a lot of ways, it's, comparison between the iPad and the Windows tablet, right? Because the iPad was a blank slate, it had to be all new what they built, and they only focused on the first things they would need. And, you get a little lack of weight there. And Windows has to take advantage of the depth of features they've got and sort of filter them down so they're usable so that it'll be ultimately a useful product and in some ways be able to cover more things sooner because it's got that framework behind it. But it's two different approaches. I think we're seeing the same thing in the younger generation of software developers. They just don't come with that same baggage. On the other hand, we provide an awful lot of value as a background. Like I was reading a great piece on the death of specifications, that nobody cares about the specs on machines anymore. And the assumption was it's because there's now a diversity, that it's all about the experience, right? That now, you don't care what OS iPad is running. You don't care what the CPU speed is, all those sorts of things. That was a construct when there was only one operating system. It was part of a great conspiracy. When everybody was running XP, the mm-hmm. only way you could market your device was to talk about how many CPU cycles it had.
Right.
And I completely reject that argument because I remember a time before XP as well. We cared, we didn't care about certain specifications in the early days of computing as well. Nobody knew what your processor speed was in your TRS-80. You know why? There was only one speed.
Yeah, exactly.
It was 1 megahertz, right? Not matter.
And nothing has changed in the Intel space. We've been at 3 gigahertz for years now. And we're probably going to be there for a while. So we're going to scale a different direction.
When they went to the P4 architecture, they got close to 4 gigahertz. And then the thing started melting down. It was too hot and so forth. And they actually went back to the P3 architecture, right? Like that, Intel doesn't want to talk about that. That whole P4 line got abandoned. It was a mistake, right? And part of it, I think, is because Intel had no competitor for so long, and they got fat and lazy and built a bad design that never really went the way it's supposed to go. They went back to the P3. That ultimately evolved into the Core 2 and this whole line. And speed is speed. But I think the real reason that specs have died is that stuff's fast enough.
Yeah.
That, the only difference between your machine and my machine is your machine computed that in half a second and mine computed in a second. Oh boy, right? Like it just doesn't matter anymore. The hardware is sophisticated enough. Now we care about experience because we're just trying to bring up the sophistication of the software to match the hardware. We don't think about whether or not a machine has the computing resources to actually do anything anymore. It does. They all do. I wrote an editorial looking at the specs on my Samsung Focus WinPhone 7. And it's basically, its specs are the same specs as the minimum specs for Windows 8. It's a 1 gigahertz processor. It needs a minimum of 1 gig of RAM, although the phone's got 8 gigs of RAM, and it needs DirectX 9 GPU. The phone's got everything that Windows 8 is specifying.
I think you just blew my mind there. That's interesting. I think there's some certain differences, of course, in ARM versus Intel and all that kind of stuff. But your point is taken, though. There's a ridiculous amount of power that we're not using.
Right. But, and because the problem here is not power, it's sophistication.
Indeed.
Right. It is how we utilize that software well and how we, you know, for a long time, Microsoft counted on Moore's Law to let the hardware be fast enough to run the software they were going to ship in 18 months.
Yeah.
Right. So whenever you demo, you know, this is one of the reasons that Microsoft got the reputation of stuff being slow, because whenever they were showing you the latest stuff, they were showing it on previous generation hardware and it wasn't fast enough for what they were trying to do. But at, from Vista onward, they went the other way. They've been lightening up the operating system over and over and over again, because the goal no longer is I need faster hardware to run this well. It's I need cheaper hardware to run this the same. And the other side of Moore's Law is not just that stuff will be twice as fast in 18 months. It's that the stuff you're buying right now will be half the price in 18 months because it's fast enough now. I don't need to go faster. Yeah. I need it less expensive. You know, the big debate around the only Windows tablets I've seen so far are $1,300. This is, well, that exact same laptop based on Moore's Law is $699 in a year.
Yeah, I wrote that article recently about an SSD, and I probably could have read it with fewer words, but the general idea was that before you go and buy a new computer, just get an SSD, because chances are the computer you have that's 3 or 4 years old will be just fine.
Yep.
You just need to get an SSD.
Although, honestly, I can't tell you how many times people said, I'm going to buy a new computer. What should I do with the old computer? And I'm like, go get your new computer. Give me your old computer. And all I've done is we've done a full reinstall and said, Here's your old computer again. They're like, Oh my God, this is great. Why did I buy a new one?
Yeah.
I said, because software is fatty food and your computer needed an angioplasty, right? Like it's just a little rotten. And So we clean it up and off it goes again. But you're right. They, you know, terms of pure bang for the buck. The only thing that breaks on computers anymore, really, are the hard drives.
Yeah, like those things fail. The things that move.
The indeed. Spinny stuff, right? Yeah, fans and hard drives. So you swap with an SSD, that problem goes away. You know, you could still make a slow machine out of an SSD, but in terms of just a simple win, that's a simple win. And it's very convenient that we had, you know, two of the big Western Digital factories get flooded, and so the hard drive prices have tripled, and suddenly SSDs don't look that expensive, and you can actually buy them, because hard drives are hard to come by right now.
Well, I think we need to leave it here. At the end of the year, our now annual Hansel Minutia with Richard Campbell. I know we could go on and on and on for hours.
Well, we do.
We do. We do all with the time. I thank you so much for your time, and this has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.